And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, Top 10, with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
I said that too.
Welcome to Monday, everybody. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour in Los Angeles. I'm Phil Lernis. In Motown, it's your friend in podcasting, Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Oh, my gosh. How am I? I am in the middle of a polar vortex. It's Ice Station Zebra. What do we call it? There's a storm. We name all our winter storms now, you know, like hurricanes. So,
yeah,
you know.
But your podcasting station, I mean, your audio station is now going to be Ice Station Zebra. That's
Ice Station
so
Zebra. Because okay, so right now, what is it? It's 14 degrees Fahrenheit, minus 10 degrees Celsius. Snow falling at a 75 degree parallel vertical. Parallel horizontal.
I feel like you're describing the plot of the latest Sylvester Stallone actioner.
It's action packed. Schools are closed in anticipation of inclement weather here in this school district. We talk about school closures.
Yeah, we used to always joke about that. How when people would ask, what is the show about? And one of the things we would say is, well, we're up to date on all the school closures, celebrity deaths, school closures. And so you've got actual school closures due to weather. Of course, in Los Angeles, just got the schools back open after a teacher strike. And
an all-night negotiation session, from what I understand.
And, I mean, they were out for several days. And, you know, and it wasn't just about money. It was about... maybe more importantly, it was about class sizes, because it's just crazy. I mean, in high school, these classes with 40, 50, 60 people in a class.
What?
Yeah.
60 people.
And and every study shows that pretty much when you get past a class size of 24, it's a problem. And if you get a class size past 30, everybody fails. So,
right.
Let's double it. Then everybody
everybody
has a study partner. Okay. So we're actually coming at you on a Monday morning. I mean, if there was breaking news going on, and there might be. I heard that Anthony Davis wants a trade from the New Orleans Pelicans. But other than that, we could handle it, but we won't. Because...
Right.
It's our turn in what we call the annual season of self-congratulations. The Oscars have had their opportunity to announce their nominations for the year, and now Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis get to talk about what they thought was most memorable, what they thought was best in the year that was for cinema. Any opening salvos, Dean Haglund, before we roll up our sleeves and dig into our lists?
Well, you know, my opening salvo, of course, is I've been living internationally. So my day and date release has quite screwed up everything. So what I've seen and what is my top 10 will have a more global feel.
And you have just enjoyed the Dean Haglund caveat that we have played at the beginning of the show for the last handful of years. Look,
right. And this is the year that caveat, because it's the last year I can do that caveat.
Well, it's interesting, though, that that is about the global feel of things, because my mea culpa, it's possibly a caveat, possibly a mea culpa. It's one or the other, ladies and gentlemen, and I won't know which until Friday. But there is one film in particular that I have not seen. Now, this year was an interesting year in film, in that I would argue there have been more good films than any year I have been alive. I was looking at this. We went through like 52 films that made Critics' Top 10 list. There are easily 70 good films that came out this year. I've never seen anything like this. However, only one great film. I mean, it's sort of ridiculous how much Alfonso Cuarón's Roma sort of lords it over the rest of cinema this year.
Where
there's one film where you go, yep, okay, that's the one that 30 years from now people still remember. Are any of these others going to be remembered? And obviously we'll see. But there might be a second great film. And it's Paul Polakowski's Cold War. I am hearing, this is the Oscar-winning filmmaker of Ida, and his new one, Cold War, got nominated not only for Best Foreign Language Film, but of course, to the consternation of ill-informed movie fans all over this country, got a Best Director nomination, supplanting Bradley Cooper in the Best Director mix. And, it reminds me of course, the year back in the 80s, I think it was 85, when, remember, Steven Spielberg does not get nominated for Color Purple, and everybody's outraged. How dare they snub him? And, some of us pointed out, could you look and see who they nominated instead? It's a little kid by the name of Akira Kurosawa. So if you're gonna get snubbed,
why not?
Yeah, exactly. That's one where you go, okay, I guess include me out, because that's good company not to be. But with Cold War, I'm hearing references to Casablanca is what I'm hearing. So I can't wait to see this. I'll be seeing it Friday. But there's the possibility that this upsets the apple cart, and the whole show gets scrubbed as soon as Friday rolls around. But that said,
so you're seeing that, yeah, you're seeing that Friday, okay.
But that said, I look at this list, and it's really tough in a year when there are so many good films. It's hard to really gravitate around 10, and in fact, look at even the Academy Awards. I mean, the nominees, it's bizarre for Best Picture. And one of the things that I found is, in a year when no films really separate themselves, it really helped those companies that have big marketing budgets. I mean, there are no independent films, unless you consider Netflix independent. And let's face it, Netflix has a bigger war chest than any other media company. So how could you? And so it's really interesting how, after so many years of indies seemingly dominating, they couldn't crack the Best Picture list this year. And it's a year, therefore, where honestly the Spirit Awards have a better collection of movies nominated than the Academy does.
Isn't that fascinating? Well, and this goes back to our conversations we had a ton of times, where awards is strictly about marketing. Marketing, television, the pressures of that is now affecting the actual decision making of the movies themselves. So that then just sort of spells a death knell to the Academies altogether, that maybe that isn't the indicator of indeed the best movie out there.
So I have three in honorable mention that are all really good films that people should see. And I just thought to show you where I'm going with my list this year because of some of these things, because there were just so many good films, this would be illustrative. One of the films that tied for the most Academy Award nominations is Yorgos Lanthimos' The Favorite. We've talked about this in years past. Did this make your list, The Favorite?
No, it did not.
No, it did not. Okay. So, no. Yeah, it's so funny. And the work by Olivia Colman and Rachel Weisz is so good. And it really does resonate in a modern context. And I think it'll hold up very, very well. But I also can't say that I'm necessarily thrilled by the prospect of seeing it again. And and more than any other year where there was just so many films that I had trouble separating, it was kind of, that was no small thing, was right. Have I already seen it again? If I've already seen it again, well, that should be a leg up for the movie. And do I want to? Or would I look forward to seeing it again? And why is that? And so those were kind of the movies, really, I was gravitating towards. Another film on my honorable mention list that I raved about when I saw it was Bo Burnham's Eighth Grade. Elsie Fisher deserved a Best Actress nomination, the young lead in it. Mm-hmm. But still, it is a coming-of-age movie, and therefore not really one that Phil Lernis is going to gravitate towards another time, unless of course it has a charming Hugh Grant performance in it, in which case then
that's the tipping point for a coming of age film.
It might be. I mean, About a Boy is the and you know the boy in About a Boy, also one of the stars of Yorgos Lanthimos, is The Favorite, but Hugh Grant nowhere to be found, sadly. And then another one, which honestly, I look at this and I go, this could be number three on my list, honestly. And I mean, really, there was a degree to which I was just throwing these up in the air and seeing which landed closest to me. Mariel Heller's Can You Ever Forgive Me, with a screenplay by Nicole Holofcener, based on Lee Israel's memoir of the same name, starring Melissa Carthy as Lee Israel. Following this writer of biographical novels as she tries to revitalize her failing career by forging letters from deceased authors and playwrights. And of course, it stars Richard E. Grant, who got an Oscar nomination, which is so well deserved and made me so happy. And this is a really tidy little movie. It's everybody's doing such great work. I mean, it should be on my list, and it's not, because it just wasn't one of a handful that I said I would watch that right now if it was in front of me.
Yeah. Well, is that the caveat? Because I mean, it sounds sort of fascinating, but for some reason, I don't know why it's not compelling me. Like you said, even if it's in front of me, would I watch it right now? I don't know if I would.
It is really fun, and it is worth it for you to see Melissa McCarthy, of course, so good and so well-received in comedies, to see her doing maybe the best dramatic performance of the year, honestly, because Olivia Colman, I think, might win for Best Actress, quite deserving. Glenn Close is building up a lot of momentum behind her for what is a shitty movie. And you know how I feel about rewarding quote-unquote great performances in bad movies. You know, a Best Actor or Actress nomination in a movie that gets no other nominations because it's no good. Is the performance that good if the movie doesn't work?
Exactly.
And if you're aware of the performance the whole time. But Glenn Close, people love her. It's been a long time since she's been nominated. She's old and hasn't won one yet, as we used to say. So,
as we used to, when did we ever say that?
No, that used to be a thing. Like, when Chevy Chase hosted the Oscars in the late 80s, he got in trouble for listing the real rules. You know how like they'll list the rules in voiceover, but then he did the real rules. You're eligible for an Oscar if you're old and haven't won one yet.
I sort of remember that.
All right, that's so funny. So let's just get into it then. Why don't you start, Dean Haglund, with always one of my favorites, number 10.
Well, let's see. You know, this one, of course, we talked about already, but it's the Coen Brothers' The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. And this shows up on my number 10 because it is a series of short films. all assembled together. And some of them I didn't like, and some of them resonated so deeply that I could just watch the one short film and nothing else. So that's why it sits at a number 10 for me. But in particular, it's Liam Neeson as the handler for the armless, legless orator actor who goes around town giving monologues from town to town until he's replaced by a chicken that can add.
And the young actor who plays the orator is so good. Played Neville Longbottom in all the Harry Potter movies. I mean,
I know, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Yeah, that when you recognize him.
Well, so it's interesting that that's the one that resonates with you and that's the one that stays with you and you gravitate towards. I actually am at the point where I now love all of them. I love all of them. I haven't seen it again. I look forward to seeing it again. But I actually love all the pieces. And what people have said to me that I think is so great is, God, that thing starts off dark and just gets darker and darker and darker and ends darkest still. And what's surprising about that and what's a nifty trick about it is it by the end of the film, the last piece, nothing happens.
They're in a wagon.
And yet it's so dark and disturbing.
Yeah.
Without anything happening. What a spell that is. So I don't know. I do think it is one of those films that is fantastic kind of for Netflix because you can watch one and go away and ruminate on it and savor it and then come back to the next one. You know, take your own little commercial breaks. And I'm not sure that that's not a great way to see that film. But I will say it hangs together really well. And the farther I go since having seen it, the more of a piece it hangs together as.
Yeah.
So anyway, so 10 right. for you, Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Number 10 for me is a tie, Dean Haglund. On some of these, I decided what I would do is author double features for people to see.
Right.
That I think is interesting. So number 10 is Green Book. And if you put a gun to my head right now and said... that I had to predict what would win Best Picture, I would point out to you, it's not Loaded.
That's pretty ballsy.
I would also point out to you that after yet another wedding shower last night, I still am loaded. And I'm sobering up, though. I got the coffee going here. Anyway.
Fantastic.
But as soon as Green Book came out, Lily Holloman said, this is your Best Picture winner this year. And damn if she may not be right. Anyway, again, Green Book, directed by Peter Farrelly of the Farrelly Brothers, follows a real life tour that took place in the 50s between the African-American classical and jazz great Don Shirley, played by Mahershala Ali, whose name is already engraved upon the supporting actor Oscar, and Tony Vallelonga, his driver, an Italian-American bouncer, and the friendship that develops between them as they attempt a two-man integration of the South on this tour. And this movie is really funny and really charming, and it, to me, is kind of the best of what sort of older Hollywood used to do. You know, these movies whose hearts are always in the right place that surprise you with how effective they are at sneaking up on you, but which also contain really, if you'll pardon the phrase, high-stepping, multifaceted performance from big, big stars. Remember that right. when that's what you could count on? From Hollywood movies. And, you know, when actors weren't doing chicken shit work in studio films. And these guys, they inhabit and breathe life into these characters. And it's really very detailed work that they do. So do you feel like you're there in the South as it was? No, you feel like you're in a movie. But a really fun, touching, charming movie. And I would say that is very much like the other film. I would say that people should sit down and watch in a double feature with it. Another movie I've talked about on this show, Stan and Ollie.
Oh,
another two-hander biographical film. This one directed by John Baird and written by Jeff Pope, based on the later years of the lives of the comedy duo Laurel and Hardy. Again, wonderful performances by Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly. And like Green Book, a film whose heart is brought to it by, in this case, two female performers. In Green Book, it's very much Linda Cardellini as Tony Vallelonga's wife. In this film, the wives are played by Nina Arianda and Shirley Henderson, and they really are spectacular and give the film its heart. What John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan do, which you've heard me talk about before, is create this really nifty trick of establishing a tone throughout the film that is funny and charming, while nevertheless always sorrowful.
And, right.
And because it's such a seemingly effortless souffle that they pull off, I feel like this film has gotten overlooked by critics, as historically so many comedies have. And and yet, as we know, that might be the hardest trick in all of storytelling, to maintain a tone like that, that combines such disparate elements. So that would be a double feature. I would say people might really enjoy watching based on historical friendships, Green Book, and Stan and Ollie.
Well, you know what? I'm going to do that as my double bill, because I have been dying to see Stan and Ollie. I'm sure it would have been on my top 10 list had I saw it. But this year, I promised just to do stuff I saw and not the ones that I think I'm going to like.
Oh, my God. You've only ever done that really once, I think. And you at least saw like 30 minutes of it. But it's fine. We've already called this. We used to call it in years past 10 10 yeah. films Dean might have seen.
Okay, so Stan and Ollie's my number 9 then.
And this year we've called this show Dean Explores the Numbers 1 through 10, not in that order.
Now you're being a dick. I can't believe
it. You can't believe it. Oh my God. The schools are closed, and I mean...
and in fact,
that's no polar vortex. That's just Phil's condescension. All right. Number 9, Dean Haglin, number 9. Oh, excellent. Dean, hold on. Breaking news.
What?
Titans will return to Netflix outside the U.S. for season 2. Seriously, that's the breaking news alert I just got.
Wow. You know, you should really change your news feed. I think that is a ridiculous breaking news item.
All right. Number 9.
Number 9. Okay. So, you know how much I enjoy geopolitical foreign policy as seen through action films from across the globe. And right now we are renegotiating our position in the global security, military, geo entertainment complex. So
you mean
it's fascinating?
You mean this podcast is doing that, or
this podcast? Yes, as we go out globally, you know, we are renegotiating how we sit in the world's thing. And so, if you remember, in the 80s, we displayed our dominance with Rambo movies. Well, now it's fascinating to see Chinese military action movies. And look no further than Hong Hei Zing Dong, otherwise known as Operation Red Sea. Holy smokes, this is a story of a Navy Marine Corps that leads a hostage rescue operation in some fictional African country and, you know, battles terrorists and rebellions. It is action-packed. It is big budget. The camera works fantastic. Directed by Dante Lam, who I don't know what else he's done. But, you know, in terms of jingoism, in terms of patriotism of Chinese might over African infrastructure. It has so many layers and such bizarre echoes to 1980s action films that I grew up with, that I continued not only to watch this, but think about it in terms of what the future direction is in terms of military might, and how what's fascinating was the Rambo movies was the individual, the army of one, the strength of one vision, whereas these this one in particular, Operation Red Sea, is about the team and how the team holds together and how the one sniper is lost and the new guy comes in, and about you know, team over individual, discipline over renegade, rebellion, all of that sort of thing. Really fascinating, well done, and but in no means is it going to win an award, but it was the top box office grossing film in China for the year 2018.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, this is a case where the biggest box office hit here for the year nominated for Best Picture.
Right.
You know, so that's your number nine. I would, for the benefit of those young people who are not able to attend schools today because of the aforementioned school closings, I will integrate as many lessons as I can. In this instance, pointing out Dean's incorrect word usage, he meant jingoism. He actually said jingleism.
I believe jingleism
yeah. would be involving the placement of songs for marketing and advertising purposes.
Very good.
And jingoism isn't.
You know, when you've been drinking, you're mean.
All right. I have a tie at number nine,
Another double bill.
A suggested double feature of two documentaries from this year, neither of which I think got nominated for Best Documentary, and yet to me, they are the two best documentaries of the year. One, Won't You Be My Neighbor, Morgan Neville's documentary about the life and guiding philosophy of Fred Rogers. I expected this to be maybe an interesting character reveal of things I didn't know. I expected it maybe to be a sentimental look back to our shared childhood memories of a certain age. I did not expect this to be such a harrowing look at the loss of decency in our culture, and I did not expect to come away thinking, you know, we need Fred Rogers now more than ever, and that is the effect of it. So Won't You Be My Neighbor? And Three Identical Strangers, the documentary directed by Tim Wardle, examining the set of American triplets born in 1961 and adopted as six-month-old infants by separate families, unaware that each child had brothers only miles away from each other. The separations were done as part of an undisclosed scientific nature versus nurture twin study to track the development of genetically identical siblings raised in different circumstances, and indeed illegally, the families were not told that they were separating these boys intentionally. And
because that would harm the experiment, theoretically.
An illegal experiment that was being run, and an experiment. The results of which will remain sealed by our government until long after the participants are all dead.
I know, meaning that we'll never know.
Well, but we will, because we're your friends in podcasting, and we're not going anywhere.
Right, but the darker implication is that this is about genetic manipulation and the future of cloning. So this is, you know, from my conspiracy friends telling me that that is the ongoing the non-disclosed experiment.
Well, you
that
know,
it pretends to.
Here's the fantastic thing about the era in which we live is that the conspiracy theory, again, serving simply to distract, serving no purpose at all. I mean, I keep getting, going back to you when we were making Truth Is Out There, saying that maybe we'd gotten to the point where the conspiracy theory was the conspiracy. And hello, welcome.
Yep.
If whether wittingly or unwittingly, it turns out that some of our biggest conspiracy theorists were pawns being used in a game of division and and misinformation, that's exactly what's going on. And here's a case where you hear this horrible story that affected these lives of these kids and denied them some of their basic rights, and affected other kids as well. There were many other kids as well that we know about this, and we immediately shift the subject to, and you know what the purposes of this are, and you know what's going on. It's like, wait a second. So we just lost sight of a human cost that we already know.
Right.
And what's our responsibility to them and to the other kids involved? And you don't need to immediately start to author a farther flung theory about this. This is bad.
Right. A narrative. There's a narrative already in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Number eight.
Well, my number eight is your double bill, Won't You Be My Neighbor. Of course, as you said, harrowing in terms of the loss of civility, but also how dark it was of his own self-doubt of had he made any difference. Did his whole, entire foray into years of television create a ripple in a pond? To me, that was even more. I actually had to stop watching it for a second and ponder all of creation, all of art, all of everything that we do. Does it make a difference? Or are we just on a track into incivility? Where are we headed? So, I thought this too was a fantastic documentary, even though I didn't really grow up with Mr. Rogers. We had in Canada the Friendly Giant, who was a giant with a rooster in a bag and a giraffe and three hep cats that played jazz in a castle. So, we had Mr. Dress-Up as well, who had a dog that could move its mouth but couldn't talk, and a little boy named Casey who could talk but his mouth didn't move. He was just a plastic head. And Mr. Dress-Up had the ability to draw. And, he had a fun time. He was sort of the Canadian Mr. Rogers. If you put Mr. Dress-Up and the Friendly Giant together, you get Mr. Rogers in America. So, yes.
I think I am Mr. Dress-Up and you're the Friendly Giant.
That's, that's not that far. Because the Friendly Giant, he didn't really do much. There was no real lessons. He played the recorder, in the beginning of every episode. And then, just sort of chatted and amiably with the giraffe and a rooster, and then the cats would play. So, right.
That's all you need. All right.
That's kind of all I need. It was an awesome 30 minutes.
Hey, I have a double feature for you at number eight, a tie, two films. One, Spike Lee's satirical comedy, Black Klansman, written by Spike Lee along with Charlie Wachtel, David Rabinowitz, and Kevin Wilmot, based on the 2014 memoir Black Klansman by the real life Ron Stallworth, a former police detective who was the first African American detective in Colorado Springs back in the 1970s. So he integrates that section of the department. And it follows him as he's doing that while at the same time infiltrating and exposing the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. And John David Washington, Denzel Washington's son, plays the lead. The film features outstanding support from Adam Driver. And as well as Laura Harrier. And maybe in the trickiest performance in the whole film, Topher Grace as real-life Grand Wizard of the KKK, David Duke. Playing him as this kind of really sort of pathetic mid-level manager type. And,
yeah, right?
And it feels so right, actually.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, I thought
this guy... This guy at the level between American anger, bubbling American anger, and between those power brokers he wishes to be in the company of.
Right. Yeah. And it's done sort of amiably and with a bit of vacuousness. I thought his performance was kind of really, because, you know, you could have played that to the real, you know, self-commenting. How evil David Duke is, or you could have done it to a completely bewildered, idiotic take on it. But he did kind of drive a picture of a guy who is, like you said, a middle manager, just trying to weave it all together.
Yeah,
I thought it was pretty kind of cool.
You know, as a political figure, it's the sort of guy that you would go, yeah, that guy could make probably a city councilman somewhere.
Yeah, right.
Not going to raise much higher than that, but that's where he probably fits in. Anyway, I thought what a fun double feature this is with another satirical American comedy dealing with issues of race. Issues of thorny integration into different milieus. And this is Blindspotting, written by, produced, and starring David Diggs and Rafael Cassell, directed by Carlos Lopez Estrada. And this is set in contemporary Oakland and deals with how white folk are gentrifying traditional black neighborhoods and the effect that this is happening. And the plot follows a parolee with 3 days left on his probation sentence or parole sentence, only to have him witness a police shooting that threatens not only his status on the outside as a parolee, but also threatens to ruin his lifelong friendship, his most loyal lifelong friendship. It's a film that's subtly about a lot of big issues and which never loses sight of that core relationship and which, thanks to especially the performance of these two guys, is so funny and also features just an amazing cameo turn by Tisha Campbell Martin. So that would be my double feature. If you want to explore some race relations in some satirical comedies, one history-based BlacKkKlansman, and the other not history, but dealing with something that's very much going on in inner-city landscapes today, Blindspotting.
Blindspotting. Fantastic. It's on my list of things to see.
Speaking of your list, what's at number seven?
Wasn't that the last one seven?
No,
that was eight. Yeah.
Trust me. when it comes to the numbers, trust me, I got you covered.
You got it. Okay. Well, next on my list, of course, is Isle of Dogs, which is Wes Anderson's stop motion animation set in the post-apocalyptic, well, is it post-dystopian, I guess, future of a world of trash where the dogs are, what are they doing? They're hanging out. they're saving the world. But just great voiceover work. I loved that Wes Anderson pacing and sense of humor, like he did in the sly Fantastic Fox, Mr. Fox. At first I was like, nah, am I going to like this? But then it really grew on me, particularly the performances and particularly that low-key delivery of all the actors. I thought combined with the dogs and the reaction, really fun. And I don't know if it played here, but he also did a short 2 minute turn off your cell phone trailers for the Australian film market, which was particularly hilarious. So Isle of Dogs.
The Isle of Dogs, number seven. My number seven is a tie that I have set up as a potential double
feature. Another double feature.
Yeah, the final one. This is the final one.
Then Are you sure?
Yeah, then I get into actually making choices. But and these are both exceptional movies that deserve to be up or near the top of anybody's list. The first is First Reformed, written and directed by Paul Schrader, starring Ethan Hawke, who is one of the biggest snubs of the year. This guy deserved a Best Actor nomination. The film only got a screenplay nomination. Ethan Hawke may have given the best performance by any lead actor this year. Also stars Amanda Seyfried and Cedric Kyles. It follows a Protestant minister faced with questions of faith and morality while serving as pastor of a dwindling historical church. And no film, no narrative film has dealt with the issues of climate change, believe it or not, in such a compelling and thorny kind of way.
Wow.
You know, saying, how do we claim morality? How do we claim to be Christian when we're doing nothing to care for and tend for God's earth? And, you know, Paul Schrader's always been attracted to religious themes or to themes of loss of religion. And I have it as one of mine for number seven. The reason I didn't feel the need to put it higher is I'm punishing him for all the shitty, shitty movies he's made and made me sit through.
Name two that you hate.
The Canyon.
Yeah, wow, that's pretty bad.
Oh my God, I just tried to watch another one that he made recently. Oh, anyway, name two. That's unfair. But
I would say Canyon's enough. Yeah, no.
I would say name two good ones that he's directed. All right. Autofocus, I guess, was okay. And all right. Anyway, and the other one, another independent drama that deals with very real world issues. Is The Rider, a drama written, produced, and directed by Chloe Zhao. The film stars Brady Jandreau, Lily Jandreau, Tim Jandreau, and was shot in the Badlands of South Dakota, and it explores the plight of modern-day rodeo cowboys and the dwindling life of the West and of cowboys, and everyone in it plays themselves, plays a variation on themselves. It's all non-actors, real-life, brain-damaged rodeo cowboy Brady Jandreau plays a real-life, brain-damaged rodeo cowboy. And it is such an amazing way to surprisingly build your emotional investment where you realize that you're absent the usual safety of watching a narrative. You might really care about what's going on with the characters, but in the back of your mind, you know, I'm watching a movie. Unless it's a documentary that you don't know much about, in which case you might go, oh God, how does this real life story end?
Right.
But you're watching this movie, and when they're telling you that if this guy gets on a horse again and gets thrown, he could die. His seizures are getting worse and worse and worse, and he can't even handle a horse ride. But because it's the thing he loves the most, and because it's a movie where we're recreating things, he has to get up on the horse. You're really worried about what's going to happen.
Right. So aren't we putting our actor, doesn't that take you out of the movie? I haven't seen this yet, but I got to think that it's going to take me out of because there is a performer at risk.
Okay. So what does a movie do? A movie traditionally, if it's well done, takes you out of the here and now. And by moving you somewhere further away from your time and your space, brings you closer to truths that might illustrate or illumine some part of your daily life.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a movie that takes you away from your here and now and then takes you away from the movie to bring you closer to a reality that actually exists. It's fascinating because what it's arguing, Dean, is that we've gotten to this point where we're not actively watching anything. We want everything mediated for us. And it reaches through the screen of a mediated experience and says, you're not off the hook.
Right. But at the same time, then we cross into a level of exploitation. Now we're exploiting this fellow's injury as a way to transmit the mediation. And therefore, is he aware with his brain injury?
But it's interesting. But you don't have a problem with that when it's documentary.
Well, or do I? Or do I now? Because now I'm wondering.
But
this now makes me go, okay, so if it's that verisimilitude going on and in borderline to a documentary, do I then do have a documentary?
Okay, but then I would ask you, what is worse, to exploit it in that way or to do what we usually do, which is to take what we want from it, put actors in it, and exploit it in a safe way? See, this is, or an Albertsons, or a Trader Joe's.
I didn't know that joke.
Yeah.
Well, there it is.
I mean, the managing partner of Safeway, Peter McGowan, died yesterday. Breaking news. So I had to throw that joke. But
celebrity deaths.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, we're in an industry built on exploitation. So now the question is, though, what's worse? The one that lets you know that it's based on exploitation or the one that makes it safe for you? See, I, having made The Lady Killers, may I say that, and I got another, review rip. It doesn't happen very often, but, but it's the one I expected, which is, it's unclear what you, Phil Lairness, as the storyteller, what your attitude towards these characters is. And basically that will piss some people off and make them uncomfortable because people want the morality of their movies cleanly demarcated. People want their art's morality neat and tidy because nobody wants to fucking explore what they actually feel.
Right.
We want to be able to enjoy our exploitation and to be told that it's all right that we're enjoying it. See, it had such a good moral to it. So we're allowed to enjoy it. It's a thorny issue. But I would say that the movie deserves to be hailed because it's forcing us to look at those things much the way that First Reformed is making us look at things. So those are my number seven. Number 16,
wow.
Haglund.
Well, it's the movie you turned me on to, the sci-fi thriller where there is a zone of fog. It's called Annihilation. And how do you describe the plot line? All female battalion of Marines go in to where a spaceship or something has landed in a zone that seems to be growing exponentially. And what they go in there and they find mind bending, changing their perception, their sense of time. Kind of fascinating. And as you said, I saw it on the big screen in Australia. But didn't get a it got a limited release here in the U.S. Is that right?
No, I don't know if limited is right. It did pretty well.
I thought you said it went straight to Netflix or something.
No.
No, it wasn't one of those.
No, it got a bigger release. It was from the director of Ex Machina, but
yeah,
I would have thought it was bigger than it was, especially since it came out early in the year. It's made a lot of critics' lists, but again, I think because of genre and because of when it came out, not getting the award love that maybe it deserved.
Interesting. Well, it got my award love. It's on my list.
All right. Excellent. Number six, Annihilation. And of course, Alex Garland, the director of it, kind of positioning himself interesting as the modern day thinking person's M. Night Shyamalan. You know, with these genre settings, these sci-fi settings, genre settings with a twist. Always with a twist. Always with a last-minute, almost nihilistic twist. All right, my number six, Isle of Dogs. The Wes Anderson stop-motion animated science fiction comedy drama film. I love stop-motion. I love science fiction. I love comedy drama. And when you put all six together...
And, so this is the jamming of every genre you enjoy.
And I would call it dystopian near future. That's what I would call it in answer to your question. The story of a young boy searching for his dog. I mean, that's what I love is at its heart. It's the boy searches for his dog. It's a lost dog story. What can go wrong there? That's gonna work. And in this case, it's after the species is banished to an island following the outbreak of a canine flu. And so there's this wonderful riff on these modern diseases, these modern flus. Get yourself inoculated. And
That's right. Right.
The voice cast is, of course, spectacular, doing such great work. I mean, Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton, Bill Murray, Jeff Goldblum, Bob Balaban, Greta Gerwig, Frances McDormand, on and on and on and on. But what about Yoko Ono, for crying out loud?
For crying out loud. I know. What a surprise.
All right.
You wouldn't. Yeah, exactly.
And by the way, I know many Wes Anderson devotees.
Yes.
And I'm a big, big fan of Wes Anderson. But people who are even bigger devotee than myself, for whom this might be their favorite Wes Anderson film.
Oh, really? Oh, that's fascinating.
Isle of Dogs.
I don't know if I'm that big a Wes Anderson fan, but it's certainly this is one of his more endearing projects, sure.
But this comes right on, you know, this is his first film after Grand Budapest Hotel. And so I think it's safe to say that he has hit another new peak in his creative output when you look at those two films side by side.
Yes. Though I got to think the time that it takes to do stop motion animation, you could film Grand Budapest Hotel just in the post-production pre-voiceover. Just assembling the movie together.
Yeah, I mean, it's taken time. It was some time off between those movies for him, and whereas he has a live action film coming out this year that started filming in November. So you're right. I mean, it is much more time consuming. But as was the case with Fantastic Mr. Fox, that film led to a breakthrough in live action for him, where he comes off of the disappointing Darjeeling Limited and goes into the really charming Moonrise Kingdom. And so that break seemed to serve him well, and what he was able to explore through animation seemed to fuel him in his next couple live action films. So it'll be very interesting to see where he goes in terms of live action now after this detour into stop motion.
Absolutely.
Number five, Dean Haglund.
Number five is your number, whatever that was, the double bill, Black Klansman with three Ks. This is also a Spike Lee joint venture, if I'm not mistaken.
It is a Spike Lee joint. Just a Spike Lee joint, not a joint venture. Yeah, no.
No, not a joint venture. But yes, as we talked, loving this movie a lot. Just also fascinating to me, it was like, okay, how did this all progress? And it seemed like it was just the whim of the police officer just answering an ad in a newspaper to start this whole investigation to bring down the whole Klan. Like that to me is it felt to me like it is a realistic historical detail because it seems so improbable. So many reenactments always have something that's like, really? Is that really how it happened? And because of its improbability, it felt so hilarious and so probable. So there you go, Black Klansman.
My number five, already discussed, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Oh, that was your five?
An American Western anthology film, written, directed, and produced by the Coen brothers. And, it features six vignettes taking place in the American frontier. And, we talked about how bleak and disturbing and dark and all of this it is. We should point out that there's a musical vignette. There is one vignette that plays out as a Shaggy Dog joke. There's really, really funny vignettes. So it's a full, rich brew in this. And I love a couple of different things about it. I love the fact that it explores many of the totally untouched stories that are available to us when exploring the Old West, right? I mean, 110, 120 years of Westerns, but really most of the stories that could be told in the Old West never explored on film. And,
interesting. Yeah, that's true, right?
And so so this starts to give you some feel for that. The other thing is one vignette in particular, the wagon train vignette. Featuring Zoe Kazan is such a wonderful piece, actually. The acting is so good, and it really gave first of all, it's fun to explore plight of women in the Old West, it's really an interesting way to explore the wagon train. You know, walking from Missouri to Oregon, because the horses need to pull your gear, so you're walking, and what does that do to your emotional reality? Anyway, so many different vignettes, but, you know, again, as a warning, the film's advertising line should be taken to heart. It's The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Stories don't die. People do.
Right. Yeah, well, that's the thing. It doesn't every story have a death in it, either implied, suggested, or talked about?
So
pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I've been thinking to Tom Waits' story and that. And like, it took me a good, you know, I'm into that movie 10, I guess it's only 10 minutes long, but it's like, who is that actor that they had cast? And to realize that was Tom Waits doing such an incredible role. And again, dark as all get out. You know,
what I also love with the Coen brothers that they're still making people just kind of scratch their heads. I love, like, right down to, well, is it a movie or is it a Netflix? You know what? And when it gets, when the Oscar nominations come out, it's like, well, we know we have to give it. What do we give it?
I know.
And you look at the three nominations it gets: adapted screenplay, maybe original screenplay. Best costumes, I think.
Best costumes.
And best song.
I know.
All right.
So you're like,
So Coen brothers, we're glad you're with us, and we don't know what to really make of your work this year. All right. Number four, Dean Haglund.
Number four. On everybody's list, everybody's talking about it. It is Roma, the story of... growing up, you know, everybody knows it. But, you know, I didn't.
The story of growing up, everybody knows it.
What? Yeah, he grows up in Mexico. It's his sentimental. And so now we're going to get to the point of sentiment. And, well, I don't know. I'm sure it's on your list. We'll talk about it. But there's some things that I didn't like about it. And perhaps I should talk to them now, because there was moments where he either, we call it a callback, or he steals from all the film directors that I studied in university, Gert Tufaux.
You just made up a director's name, Gert Tufaux. So
I'm thinking of everybody.
There are overt and subtextual references to the giants of world cinema.
Yes, over and over again.
But it's about when he fell in love with movies and why he fell in love with movies.
So it's good to steal from everybody he fell in love with.
Well, I mean, he points out even how he stole Gravity, where Gravity comes from, right? Because he shows himself watching that as a little kid. It's, you know, if you're going to criticize that, then you're going to start criticizing Fellini's Amacord. I mean, everybody gets influenced.
Yes.
You're basically blaming a little kid for going and getting influenced. I mean, I think that's part of it. While at the same time showing in rather shocking detail what the world was like, both in terms of his domestic existence and in terms of the political reality of the time, and
just outside the door,
neither of which are things that this white kid growing up at roughly the same time in America could have possibly imagined and was not taught about at all.
So it's
a pretty tricky kind of combination that I think is in no small way subversive.
Ah, interesting. You see that as subversive as opposed to more. going to say morally bankrupt, but no, I guess it is subversive. So
I would not. I would not, if I were you, lose sight of the opening image and the closing image. You know, the most dominant image in the movie and its significance, which is the gated driveway covered in dog shit.
Yes, covered in water that is washing away the dog shit.
Yes,
that,
there you
that.
Go. So is it? So you want to throw him under the bus for the things that he's stealing, but is it in no small way a critique of
the
how cinema does that very thing? Wipes away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a long, long opening master shot. And if this were a dream, and when we're interpreting dreams, we say, you know, the opening line when you describe the dream tells you what the dream is about. So that opening shot is telling you thematically what the movie is about. I would, were I you, Dean Haglund, go back and reappraise it from that.
I am reappraising it. This is the whole thing why it's on my list.
Right.
Originally, I wanted to put it on my list because I'm like, oh, but now, of course, it is on my list because indeed I did love it. And yet, at the same time, I'm talking out the things that stick in my craw, because perhaps there are the very issues I'm dealing with in my work.
But just for something to stick in your craw in this day and age is no small thing. Almost a heroic Herculean effort, I think, for something to grab you that much.
Yes.
So we'll talk a little bit more about this later on. But my number four is a political satire from maybe the best in the business when it comes to political satire, writer-director Armando Iannucci. It's Death of Stalin.
That's my next one.
This is an ensemble cast, as he always puts
so
together. Is it the best screen role Steve Buscemi's ever had?
I think so, you
getting
know.
To play Nikita Khrushchev, and who would think, like, that's Steve Buscemi, that guy, the Coen brothers, Steve Buscemi, like, that guy is going to be Nikita Khrushchev someday. Simon Russell Beale, Patty Considine, Rupert Friend, Jason Isaacs, Michael Palin, Andrea Riseborough, Jeffrey Tambor, who I know we're not supposed to enjoy because he's persona non grata now, but honestly, this casting, all the things that make you dislike Jeffrey Tambor work in favor of the performance too. And Anyway, it's based on a French graphic novel, La Mort de Staline, and it depicts the power struggle following the death of the Soviet revolutionary and politician Joseph Stalin in 1953. And talk about a movie that transports you from the here and now, well back in time, in order to bring you closer to present day realities. I've now watched this film three times, and if this came on right now, I would drop everything and watch it again. What struck me the first time I saw it was, I'm not really laughing, but why is a comedy stressing me out so much? Why am I so tense in a rather ridiculous freewheeling comedy? Because it is ridiculous and freewheeling, and yet I'm freaked out.
Yes, the implications that this is the machinations of power, and that power translates to the death of thousands of people, as mentioned in the movie.
The implication that the halls of power are a farcical slapstick comedy.
Yeah.
And that they have life and death consequences 100% of the time.
It's
so disturbing and gets me so tightly wound, and that you find yourself rooting for a military coup. Please,
for the love of God. Yes.
Oh my God. And so now, as I watch it again and again, it gets funnier and funnier. And I'm able to appreciate just so much of the work that these actors are doing, and probably in no small way, given the way that he makes these and given these ensembles, what these actors are being allowed to find in the moments.
Every frame,
every scene, you can explore differently as a viewer if you want, and find different character things that are really hilarious.
I even love that it's framed with the concert that's given, where they forget to record it, and now Stalin wants a copy of that recording that he just heard on the radio. They forgot to record it, so now they have to have everyone come and stay and redo the entire concert performance with the live audience, and that poor director trying to corral everyone. That, to me, just as much tension as the rest of the movie.
Yes.
Speaking
thematically. I'm glad you brought that up. That you're right. And the first time I saw it, it was like so tense. And now I'm watching it and I'm going, oh my God, these people are doing some of the best comedic acting. I mean,
so good.
Patty Considine is so funny as the radio station manager or producer. You're dripping sweat. Your nerves are so racked the first time you see it.
It's life and death. Because it is the regime that killed somebody for such a slight offense back then.
It's a really wicked work that I think will really stand the test of time, and I look forward to growing old with. Anyway, that's my number four. Are you saying that's your number three?
That's my number three, then.
Well, that's exciting. We saved a little time there. And my number three visits Southeast Asia, Dean Haglund. Or hails to us from Southeast Asia. The first film from South Korea to make it onto the short list for the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. It does not get nominated. So many great films from South Korea that we have been hailing on this show over the last dozen years or so. And this is the first one to make the short list. And they have such a big film industry there. They partner with America to make so many movies. So that's sort of astonishing and ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But this is a psychological drama mystery film from director Lee Chang-dong. It's called Burning, and it's based on the short story Barn Burning by Haruki Murakami, great writer, especially of kind of spooky tales. And it competed for the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, and this movie, the way it brings you into its mystery. A young aspiring writer has yet to find what it is he wants to write about, has a chance encounter with a girl he grew up with who seems to be seducing him. But is she seducing him for purpose? Is she seducing him into something that will get him in trouble? And then what we know is that she's seducing him into taking care of her cat while she while she may or may not go on a trip from Korea to Africa. And when she may or may not have come back from this trip to Africa, while this guy may or may not have been taking care of a cat that may or may not exist because he never sees it. He's introduced to her new, would it be her boyfriend? Is it somebody to make him jealous? What is this guy's story? He's charming. He seems maybe a little bit of a sociopath. He's played by the Korean-American actor, this new man in her life, Steven Yeun, and it's a performance that's outstanding. But what I love about the lead performance, the actor who plays the aspiring writer, is that he doesn't feel the need ever to be interesting. He plays the character, and the character is rather lifeless and colorless compared to this flamboyant new man in this girl's life. And and then the real mystery begins when the girl disappears. And there's another subplot about the aspiring writer's father, who's on trial for an assault that he committed. And so it's weaving, and the father lives just across the demilitarized zone and is hearing propaganda from North Korea all morning long. It's a rich brew of a lot of different elements of Korean culture, of Korean class consciousness, of the creative inspiration and application, it is a violent, nifty mystery thriller, and it has one of the big takeaways from any movie of the year for me, where the girl is talking about why she's so good at pantomime, and she demonstrates by eating a tangerine, and when you're watching the movie, or not eating a tangerine, she pantomimes eating a tangerine. And while you're watching the movie, you're going, wow, that's really good. Like, I believe she's eating a tangerine that doesn't exist. And she says the key is not pretending that there's a tangerine. It's forgetting that there isn't one.
Oh, say, that's a metaphor for all of Chill Pack Hollywood.
What? So anyway, my number three, a great mystery, South Korea's Burning.
Wow. Fantastic. Awesome. Now that takes us to our number two, doesn't it?
It does. What's number two, Dean Haglund?
Well, this one we talked about before, but this is the long-lost Orson Welles film, finally cut together, The Other Side of the Wind. An epic movie within a movie, the making of a movie, the director who can't make the movie. It goes with the documentary of the making of The Other Side of the Wind, of which I stopped watching 20, 30 minutes into it so I could watch the movie first, then go back to the documentary so there weren't so many spoilers.
Yeah.
And great performances, really fascinating. A history of the film itself, stuck in Iran, the whole story on its financing, and finally put together. And I've watched this twice now, and I am always hypnotized, I think is the term. I'm hypnotized into its pacing and into its circular descent into a maelstrom of one's psychological profile. It's really kind of
is it, you know, is it a great film? I don't know. If at the end of the day, the finished film is a great film, I don't know. Is it a tough film for most people to watch? I'm sure it is. But is it one of a few movies, if we can say that movies can matter, is it one of a few movies that actually matter? Yeah, then this would be one of them. And it's and it's my number two.
And it is.
It was an experimental film by design. And at the same time, I mean, you got to love Orson Welles, who thinks, yeah, what will I do as an effort at a big Hollywood comeback? I'll make an experimental film.
Right, exactly. Well, as an artist, then that's exactly what he did. I mean, theoretically, Citizen Kane was a big experimental film.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right?
And it's the first film that he made, and it's also the one that ruined his career.
right.
But so on this one, shooting began in 1970. And, of course, he intended it to be his Hollywood comeback. He would resume shooting on and off until 1976. He would intermittently work on the project into the 1980s, but because, as you referenced, it became embroiled in legal, financial, and political complications dating back to the fall of the Shah of Iran, who whose family had invested in the film, it never was allowed to be completed during his lifetime, during Welles' lifetime. He utilizes, as you mentioned, a film within a film narrative. It follows the last day in the life of an aging Hollywood film director seeking a comeback who hosts a screening party for his unfinished latest project. In real life, Orson Welles was allowed one screening at a house party of his unfinished project. It was shot in an unconventional mockumentary style featuring, you know, a rapid editing approach in both color and black and white. It was intended as a satire of the passing of classic Hollywood, of the age of avant-garde filmmakers in Europe and New Hollywood in the 70s.
The mock.
It would also still, quite frankly, serve as a satire of our love of mockumentaries. This film manages to satirize what it but a genre it more or less creates, because they didn't exist at that time.
And that's right.
You know, for many years it was referred to as the Holy Grail of cinema. And now that it's finally in a finished form, we won't say completed, but in a finished form, Orson Welles is still teaching us. I mean, honestly, his mockumentary approach ought to be studied by documentary filmmakers, because there's a lot of life to be taken from this and injected into the documentary form. You know, he did with F for Fake. I mean, F for Fake still ought to be inspiring more documentary filmmakers. But also, man, the film within a film footage, and like you said, the hypnotic quality of going back and forth. And then for all the rapid cutting of it, Dean, you get into these scenes in the second half of conversation that are so quiet and so still and so mesmerizing. And I am blown away how we're into some next level acting, the likes of which I don't know if I've ever seen before. And it's in no small part a product of how the juxtaposition between the way he's shooting these and the sound design of these versus everything that has come before.
Yeah. And it seems like he's accidentally caught performances of the actors. And yet, looking at the documentary of the making of the movie, you realize these are carefully constructed takes with, you know, full clapperboard and everything, but done with such craft as to look completely haphazard and improvisational. It's really, you know, exactly what you want when you reach the height of your craft, to make it all look so effortless as almost to be accidental.
So we are 80 minutes into this haphazard and improvisational discussion. of our top movies of 2018. So, Dean Haglund, why don't you round off your list with a number one selection?
Well, I already talked about this in past. I still think about this as the funniest movie I saw all year, a souffle, a comedy called The Breaker Uppers out of New Zealand. It's Madeline Sammy, Jackie Van De Beek, the funny comedians. They play two friends who have a company that go in and just end relationships. When the guy can't do it themselves, they pose as either the other woman or police officers saying he's dead or whatever. And one of them gets a conscience and starts derailing their jobs and their company. It is funny. It is unbelievably tight. The chemistry between the two, clearly they've had a sketch comedy group together or something. I don't know much about them, but I love this movie. Think about it often and think about just the ability of the two of them to let a souffle of a comedy stay as light as it does at a time when most of the comedies I see from elsewhere are so heavy. You know what I mean? So the gags are bashed over their head with force and immaturity. Anyway, The Breaker Uppers, my number one.
So my number one, is it my favorite film of the year? No. but is it the one truly great film made this year? Maybe there are others, but it's certainly it's certainly one of the only truly great films this year.
Right.
In that it achieves greatness, and it's from Alfonso Cuarón. It's
yes.
Roma. And, you know, there are a lot of really great filmmakers working today. We've mentioned the Coen brothers. We mentioned Wes Anderson. Mm-hmm. There's so mm-hmm. many around the world. Alfonso Cuarón has separated himself in that he belongs with so many of those filmmakers that he overtly references in this movie.
Yes.
The Bergmans, the Fellinis. He is a giant of international cinema for all time. And I love that the movie of all times, right now, as we're struggling globally, not just here with the wall, but globally, the struggle of not only immigration, but also
right.
post-racialism. We're struggling with that. We're struggling with culture issues of cultural identity and ethnic identity in a way that it's all starting to be on the table. And
yes.
for this movie to come out now and to reveal how his upbringing and his artistry were influenced by these voices from the industrialized North as much as they were by voices from his own culture. And now we live at a time where it's images and memories of films from south of the border that will be influencing and affecting the upbringing of people growing up in this country.
Right.
That's fascinating. And I would say this about Roma. And it reminds me of Omicord in this way, and it's something I say from time to time. We don't remember plot. We don't even necessarily remember characters. When it comes to movies that we love, we remember ultimately moments, much
yes.
like with our lives and much like with the people that we love. We remember moments and we remember them for how they made us feel. There are indelible moments in this
that is true.
Film. There's one image, apropos of nothing, but I just bring this up. When the lead actress of Yalitza Aparicio, who plays a housekeeper, goes with the family to whom she serves, goes with them for a Christmas holiday at a rancho somewhere outside Mexico City. And
right.
She's downstairs partying with some of the other servants. And she decides to go check in on her wards. and she comes up out of the staircase to this walkway where she sees her mistress, the woman for whom she works, and a man that is not this woman's husband makes a pass at her. And there are fireworks going off, and the lit up house is in the background. And I don't need to know why this is so. I only need to know that as long as I live, I will never forget that image.
No, interesting. That's the one that stands out for you. I mean, it is great. It's composed fantastically. And as you said, the whole thing in black and white, you remove the color, and yet I remember the movie as so colorful, you know.
Oh, that's fascinating.
That in my head, there's so much going on, so much attention to detail that it almost enlivens itself in color in my own memory of the movie.
Yeah, it set aside from the conversation of the movies of 2018 in that it definitely is a work of art. And
yes,
we've got a whole lot of movies we've talked about, and we have this work of art. And and one of the things that I'm fascinated by, and we got to go, but is what this movie potentially could do to the Oscars. I love that a foreign language film is nominated for Best Foreign Language Film and Best Picture, and has a chance to win Best Picture. It also... he's the front runner for Best Director. We know that in recent years, the Academy loves to share the wealth, so to speak. But how do you do that? Because if you say, okay, well, this film deserves a Best Foreign Language Film, so let's give another movie Best Picture. Well, then Alfonso Cuarón's probably going to win two Oscars as a director. And the director of Best Picture won't win anything. Because the director of foreign language film gets the Oscar for foreign language film. But the director of Best Picture gets nothing because there's a Best Director category. So, but then what if they do give it Best Picture? Will it win Best Picture but not Best Foreign Language Film? And would they give that to something else? I mean, I just can't wait to see what a monkey wrench this throws into things.
It really does. Hilarious.
All right. So that's
awesome.
We talked about a whole bunch of movies. I think that was a very good show.
Yes.
We are Mr. Dress Up and the Friendly Giant.
You know, in Canada, that has a very funny connotation. Yes.
Everywhere, I would tell you, that has a very funny connotation.
Excellent. Well, till next week.
Yeah. I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Bye.
Guests of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.